From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Today on Fox News, Trump advisor Kellyanne Conway responded to the question of why the president hasn't remarked on the sexual misconduct allegations against Alabama Republican Senate candidate Roy Moore, but tweeted that a sexual harassment allegation against the Democrat Al Franken was really bad.
Well, Al Franken was a brand new news story yesterday, and the president weighed in, as he does on the news of the day, often enough. The Roy Moore story is 8 days old, and the president put out a statement during his Asia trip on that. And since then, our press secretary has spoken on behalf of the president mm-hmm. by saying that he believes the people of Alabama will sort out what to do with Roy Moore and with that election.
The firestorm over sexual harassment by politicians and sexual misconduct by politicians almost overshadowed the other big news out of Washington this week. Votes by the House and a Senate committee to advance the largest tax cuts in decades, which critics say benefit the wealthy. Our Friday Politics Roundtable joins us now. Domenico Montanaro, NPR lead politics editor. Hi, Domenico.
Hey there.
And Jose Diaz-Balart, news anchor with Telemundo and NBC. Hi, Jose.
Hey, how are you?
Doing well. And let's start with some of these sexual misconduct allegations. President Trump said the Franken allegations are really bad, but he has not said really anything, despite what Kellyanne Conway just said there. He really hasn't said anything about the allegations against Roy Moore. Domenico, what's going on? Why is he being so silent on this?
Well, I don't know why he's being so silent, but we do know that he is. We know that there's a big difference between what the president tweets and what he leaves to the press secretary to say on his behalf. And certainly if he wanted to weigh in on Roy Moore and take a firmer stance, then, well, you know, if he did these things, if these allegations were true, then it would be problematic, and leave it to Sarah Huckabee Sanders to say something rather than he himself coming out. I mean, he remarked on the UCLA basketball players that they should thank him for helping get them out of a potential prison sentence in China. So if he wanted to weigh in, he certainly could have.
Well, you know, Jose, we're wondering if we're in another moment of time where we're thinking about another moment in history. You know, President Trump, as a candidate, he bragged about groping women. He was caught on tape bragging about it. You have another president in recent memory who also probably can't weigh in on questions of impropriety because he also was accused of it. And I'm talking about Bill Clinton. And this is the storm brewing. You have New York Democratic Senator Kirsten Gillibrand. She was asked by The New York Times if Bill Clinton should have resigned over having consensual sexual relations with White House intern Monica Lewinsky. Let's listen.
Yes, I think that is the appropriate response. But I think things have changed today, and I think under those circumstances, there should be a very different reaction. And I think in light of this conversation, we should have a very different conversation about President Trump and a very different conversation about allegations against him than is currently than what has been had to date and what's currently being had.
Jose, talk about this interesting, complicated moment we're in.
Yeah, and yet she was with the president, the former president, and with Hillary Clinton when they were campaigning just last year. And look, it's I oftentimes think if there weren't evidence that just is undeniable, like the photo, you know, would things be so dogmatic?
Which photo?
The photo of Senator
Al Franken.
Al Franken,
for example, and the tape, the audio tape of President Trump with Billy Bush on the bus. If these things didn't exist, would we be so dogmatically? Would we see things so clearly? And I think that really is too bad because people who speak up and scream out that they have been abused in some way or another should at least be listened to with respect and sensitivity, regardless of what political persuasion they may be from. And I applaud my friend Ronan Farrow and his work in
The New Yorker, Yorker
and certainly the New York Times and what he's been doing over, you know, in a series of articles to just show how difficult it is personally for people to speak out and then how many times they are, you know, bombarded with criticism and threats and intimidation over something they didn't ask for. I don't know. You know, I see the picture and I go, well, not much you can say. You can't say it wasn't me.
Is there a false equivalency going on here, though? Because the things that Al Franken is accused of is very different than what Roy Moore is being accused of.
True. and different than what, you know, Weinstein may be accused
right.
of. Everything is different, but that doesn't minimize that every single case that a woman or a man is intimidated, threatened, to that person, it is many times life-changing. I wish we just had more focus on listening to with sensitivity what people who are valiant enough to come out and say, this happened to me, and it happened to me by someone who is powerful and could even threaten my professional future, to listen to them.
Well,
regardless of
some people are, and some people are apologizing,
that's right.
and some people aren't. And Domenico, I just to that point of, you know, how it intersects with politics, you know, that we have a top leader who maybe can't comment on it, that we are now having this sort of retroactive questioning about a past president. I mean, just, you know, where do you think this is going to go?
Well, look, I mean, also we should note that President Trump himself, there were more than a dozen women who
exactly.
came forward during the election to accuse him of sexual assault or unwanted touching or, you know, sexual misconduct. We had to have a tracker during the campaign on our website to show – to break down just who these women were because there were so many. So I think we are at a different point in all of this, when talking about the workplace and when talking about sexual harassment. Of course, we're talking about it being here at NPR, and we're
right.
in the midst of all of that happening right now, where the head
media
of our news division –
figures have suffered
yeah.
because
– I mean, the head of our news division had to resign,
right.
You know. So there's plenty – to go around, and it's touching all industries.
All right. Well, we cannot go through this entire segment without talking about tax cuts, because it was a big week this week on that front. The House passed its tax cut plan with no Democratic support. A Senate panel passed its plan, which would mean that it heads to the full Senate maybe sometime after Thanksgiving. But, Jose, a lot of people saying this is just a tax plan that's going to benefit the wealthy. This is not what President Trump ran on, trying to help the forgotten man.
Yeah. And you know, look, I was just – I mean, there's a report in today's Wall Street Journal about how the House bill would, for example, eliminate tax breaks on bonds used by affordable housing developers, you know, cutting down, if it becomes law, 700,000 units over 10 years of affordable housing, something so desperately needed in this country. So, you know, it all depends, I guess, on what the final – bill looks like when it comes out of the Senate, and then it goes back to getting something. But I've got to tell you, there's a lot of concern here. On the other hand, it's you know, the president's big policy, if he gets this through, was a promise that he made.
Well, again, congressional researchers concluded yesterday that the Senate plan would actually raise taxes on people with incomes
right.
under $75,000 while cutting taxes for corporations and the wealthy. It led to a big fight in the Finance Committee. Chair
yeah.
Orrin Hatch pushed back against Ohio Democrat Sherrod Brown, who'd accused Republicans of thinking about the rich. Let's listen to a little. It went on for a while, but first Hatch, then Brown.
I come from the poor people. And I've been here working my whole stinking career for people who don't have a chance. And I really resent anybody saying that I'm just doing this for the rich. Give me a break. I get kind of sick and tired of it. Now, true, it's a nice political play.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
it's not true.
With all due respect, I get sick and tired of the richest people.
Regular
in the
order,
country,
Mr. Chairman.
Getting richer.
Listen, regular
and
order.
It went on and on. And Domenico, your thoughts?
Sounds like Thanksgiving. you know, I mean, here's the thing, right? The Republicans right now are very close to passing this bill, and the fight, the real fight, has only just begun, because there are some differences between the House and Senate bill that have to be reconciled in a conference. They want to try to push this through and get it done potentially by Christmas. That's their goal. So, you know, when you look at something like what Jose is talking about with the affordable housing credit, or you think about medical deductions,
yep.
where you have parents of children who are disabled who write off a lot of their expenses, over 10% of their income, people in nursing homes who wind up using it because they're on fixed income. Once all of that starts to become part of the protest, part of the debate, there are going to be a lot of changes to this
right.
bill, and there's not a lot of time to get it all finished.
We've just got about a minute left, Jose, but I want to ask you a quick question. We've seen the news today that the CEO of PREPA, which is the Puerto Rican power company, has resigned. according to a spokeswoman for the governor. And, you know, this is the power company that was involved in the deal with Whitefish Energy, the Montana company with just two full-time employees, which got a big no-bid contract.
Yeah.
But my question to you is, it's been many weeks now. Still, more than half of Puerto Ricans have no power. Has that been forgotten by the Trump administration or by officials?
You know, it's coming up on 2 months. Think about this, 2 months, and there are still millions of people that are living under extreme inconvenience, to put it lightly. And these are American citizens. These are people who have in many times, you know, volunteered when this country has asked for volunteers to go to war and defend this country. And so the fact is that this is not that this is not on the front burner of all of our issues is an embarrassment to me.
Jose Diaz-Balart at Telemundo and NBC, and Domenico Montanaro at NPR. Thank you to both of you.
You're
welcome.
It's been just over 1 year since a wave of ballot initiatives brought the total number of states to legalize marijuana for medical or recreational use up to 29, plus the District of Columbia. Pot remains illegal under federal law. Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who opposes legalization, was pressed on that in congressional testimony this week by Tennessee Democrat Steve Cohen.
I would hope you'd look at marijuana and look at the states as laboratories of democracy and see how they've helped. In states where they've got medical marijuana, they have 25% less opioid use. It gives people a way to relieve pain without using opioids, which inevitably leads to death and crime. And so I would hope you take a look at that.
We will take a look at it, and we'll be looking at some rigorous analysis of the marijuana usage and how it plays out. I'm not as optimistic as you.
Joining us now from Miami is Ryan Nurz. He's a correspondent for Fusion and author of the book Marijuana America. Ryan, welcome back.
Thanks a lot, Jeremy. Good to be here.
And let's go through some of the states that legalized recreational marijuana last year. California, Maine, Massachusetts, and Nevada all passed ballot measures legalizing recreational pot. Of those states, how many of them have actually opened dispensaries?
Thus far, just Nevada. In July, it was the first month of legal recreational weed sales. They had $27 million in sales in the first month, which almost doubled what Oregon and Colorado sold. And lines have been out the door, and their sort of weed tourism game looks strong right out of the gate. The rest of them are doing what always happens with these initiatives. They're fretting and thinking about the details. And, you know, there's a lot of weed insiders that say legal weed years are like dog years. It just takes a long time to sort out these laws.
So how long do you think it'll take for some of these other states, including California, to get these dispensaries open?
So California is recreational weed will be legal on January 1st, 2018. And it looks like the laws just came out yesterday, actually. And the wild, wild west of weed is about to get significantly wilder there. They will allow for huge farms there, which sort of stokes this eternal battle between mom and pop growers and the sort of Walmartization of marijuana. Other states, it just depends on the state. Maine is really struggling to implement the law because Governor Paul LePage is not helping. He's very, very anti-marijuana, calls it a dangerous gateway drug. Vermont, their governor vetoed their bill. Massachusetts has been mired in a lot of sort of hand-wringing about the details. Their sales tax just went from 12 to 20%, and sales are going to start in July of 2018.
And four other states legalized medical marijuana or greatly expanded access to it: Arkansas, Florida, Montana, and North Dakota. Have those states moved forward in implementing those laws in the past year?
So it's the same thing. There's a lot of hand-wringing, and it's moving slowly. I'm here in Florida, and they've moved towards it. You know, we have a very Republican, sort of staunchly anti-marijuana governor, Scott, but he's allowing it to go forward. There's 17 dispensaries It's very, very restrictive. But that's the case in all four of these states, that they're just really, really working out the laws. And 2018 should start to see some of these dispensaries pop up.
Now, even in states where weed is legal, you often cannot smoke it in public. You can't smoke pot in public. In Denver, the city voted last year, and marijuana has been legal in Denver for years now, the city voted to legalize the social use of marijuana in permitted private establishments. Have they started implementing that?
They have not started implementing that. And that is actually revolutionary. Almost every one of these marijuana laws, there's 30 medical marijuana states now, and 8 recreational states. None of them have allowed people to smoke in public. And that's the same as it was in Amsterdam for years before. There's a lot of entrepreneurs waiting for, you know, marijuana coffee shops, outdoor sort of bars, basically turning into, you know, places where you can go outside on a terrace. And, you know, it creates an issue of, you know, do you really want people smoking a joint on the street with kids rolling by in strollers and things like that? I mean, there are some things even the staunchest pro-marijuana people are a little concerned about with those developments.
We heard from Jeff Sessions at the top of this segment, the attorney general. He is obviously against this push for legalized marijuana. Is he likely, though, to take steps to crack down on states that have legalized marijuana since it remains illegal under federal law?
That is a major question in the blossoming marijuana entrepreneurial world. And everyone's waiting to see what Jeff Sessions will do. And obviously, you know, he's very, very anti-marijuana and very concerned about it. And I think that there's a very good chance that he would go after it. I think the only thing is that Trump is a business guy, right? I mean, he's put his entire reputation on drumming up more business. And the fact is that the amount of tax revenue that's coming into these states is just hard to deny. You know, 60% of our states now have medical marijuana laws on the books. That is maybe we're at the point of no return.
That's Ryan Nurz, a correspondent for Fusion and author of the book Marijuana America. Ryan, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Well, in Colorado, where sales of recreational marijuana have been legal since 2014, scientists are literally driving around federal law to conduct their research. It happens in a converted Dodge van nicknamed the Canavan. Sam Brash of Colorado Public Radio explains why researchers have to take their work on the road.
There's one source of marijuana for clinical research in the United States. It's a 12-acre cannabis farm at the University of Mississippi, run by the National Institute on Drug Abuse, or NIDA. Researchers battle through piles of paperwork to request the drug. And then
one day after you pass through all those hoops, your government marijuana just arrives in the mail.
That's Cinnamon Bidwell. She is a cognitive scientist at the University of Colorado Boulder. She says cannabis available in Colorado is much stronger than what the government provides for research. THC is the main psychoactive compound in cannabis, and Bidwell found that government pot has an average THC potency of 5 or 6%.
And now your average THC potency in Colorado is something closer to 16.5%.
Ken Hutchison is another scientist in Bidwell's lab. After legalization, he wanted to study the effects of the more potent marijuana on the Colorado market.
And so the first thing we did was we thought, well, we'll bring people into our lab on campus, have them use cannabis, and then study the effects.
The request hit a snag with the CU Boulder legal team. The university receives more than $300 million a year in federal research grants. If scientists didn't follow the letter of federal law, the legal team worried the government could take away that money. It meant scientists couldn't buy, dose, or even touch cannabis from a Colorado pot shop for their work. So Hutchison went back and forth with the lawyers.
And what we came up with was we can't bring people to campus and have them use cannabis, but we can bring the lab to the people.
Enter the Canavan.
Beautiful.
Here's how the van works. Scientists assign study participants, who are all regular marijuana users, a certain cannabis product. They buy it on their own. When the van shows up, they enter sober and run through a battery of tests. Then they go back into their homes, get as high as they want, and return to the van for the same tests. Taylor Armstrong is a research assistant who works on the Canavan. He ran me through the test battery.
Are you ready to start?
Ready.
Cool.
It starts with a breathalyzer just to make sure alcohol won't interfere. There's a blood draw to see how much THC is in a subject's system. Then participants memorize a list of grocery items.
Toothbrush, lemons, bacon.
They take some cognitive tests on an iPad.
Are these the same? That's right.
And do a balance test and a driving simulation. Then they try to recall that grocery list from earlier.
Toothbrush, bacon, gum. I'm losing it. Man, this is hard.
Memorization isn't my strong suit. And just to be clear, I was completely sober. Anyway, participants earn $150. Bidwell says the van has one clear advantage in the current legal landscape.
We're able to add the elements of laboratory control that we would like to have in place without dosing them or providing the products.
And she can observe impairment right after use. Hutchison, the other Canavan researcher, says there are also clear drawbacks.
We don't control the dose. We don't control how they take it. So that means there's a lot of variability in the data.
While it's imperfect, newer products like marijuana concentrates have made their research more urgent. Bidwell says high-end concentrates
have potencies of THC that are very regularly up to 90%.
That's 90, like 90.
We're talking about, you know, a very different animal.
Sales of concentrates in Colorado nearly tripled between 2014 and 2016. That's according to BDS Analytics, a cannabis data company. One van study looks at the effects of concentrates. Another looks at the effects of more traditional forms of marijuana. That one's paid for by the National Institute on Drug Abuse, the same organization that provides low-potency marijuana to researchers. Kent Hutchison says federal authorities might have been unsure of his methods at first, but they've come around.
There's some sympathy on the part of reviewers for this situation, where we desperately need the data, and there's no good way to do it other than the way we've identified.
In other words, even the feds are climbing aboard the Canavan. For Here and Now, I'm Sam Brash in Denver.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 100 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Plus, get access to over 6 million resumes. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/here.
Earlier this week, the Zimbabwe military put President Mugabe under house arrest in what looked like a coup, but was said to be an attempt to prevent Mugabe's wife Grace from taking power and allow the former vice president to take it. Today, though, Mugabe was allowed to leave his home to preside over a university graduation. So is he really on his way out? Harry Davies is the managing editor of the Harare News in Zimbabwe. He joins us now by Skype. Harry, what's your take on that appearance at the university?
I think a lot of Zimbabweans were pretty outraged to see him in public like that. But analysts are saying it was a smart move by the army to allow that appearance. It gave an air of normalcy and calm to the situation. It's clear to everyone there's absolutely no going back on what they've done so far. And there's no doubt in my mind, certainly, that they're going to keep pushing ahead with their plans.
Yesterday, we also had pictures of the 93-year-old Mugabe posing and smiling with those military leaders who are keeping him in his home. And so some are concerned that he's managed to work some sort of backroom deal.
I think the leading theory on that front is that Mugabe's been buying himself time while he waits for leaders from the region to wade in, as they did at the last election, which many people saw as rigged and violent. The regional leaders endorsed that election, and they're hoping that they'll stand by that endorsement and wade in to restore Mugabe to power. Mugabe is extremely wily and intelligent politician. He's fended off very fearsome and brave foes over and over and over again over 37 years. And he's not a man who is told what to do. It's going to take even more pressure than he's under now to make him resign. But even as we speak, that pressure is mounting, and civil society, opposition parties, and even his own ZANU-PF party are, as we speak, uniting to come together for what some people are calling a mega march, a mega demonstration, call it what you will, tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock in Harare.
Yeah, and remind people, you know, we've been reporting on this, but why the upset?
Mugabe became president of Zimbabwe in 1980, the first president soon after independence, and immediately almost showed his true colors by getting rid of political opposition in Matabele land through the covert killing of nearly 20,000 people. That track record continued. Time and time again, Mugabe maneuvered through elections in a dubious manner until ultimately it was just plain for everyone to see. It was outright rigging. There was horrendous election violence, and the corruption just got worse and worse. We've been through hyperinflation, gross human rights abuses, and we're currently entering a second phase of hyperinflation.
But his replacement, Mnangagwa, also was implicated in atrocities and ethnic massacres and said to be corrupt. But we're hearing that much of the world just sees him as the best option to Mugabe.
Mnangagwa has been the man winning the elections for Mugabe using the army. But I think people are so anxious to see Mugabe, and not just him, but his wife, who was vying to be president and whom everybody's very afraid of. They wanted to see those two gone as a first step towards democracy down the line.
Well, we'll see what happens tomorrow with this march, Harry. Harry Davies, managing editor of the Harare News in Zimbabwe. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
There's a new documentary premiering this weekend about the Simpsons character Apu Nahasapima Petalon, known for his distinctive accent and his catchphrase.
Thank you. Come again.
Apu is the penny-pinching owner of the Quickie Mart. He's been a fixture of the show since 1990, but the new documentary is asking the question, is that character racist?
Despite only being said 8 times over the entire course of The Simpsons' history, Thank You, Come Again has haunted Indian children for over a quarter century. Why? It's funny because it's racist.
This could take a while, folks. Thank you. Come again.
That's Indian-American comic Hari Kondabolu. He is behind the True TV documentary airing this Sunday. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans joins us now. Eric, tell us about it.
Yeah, so Hari is an up-and-coming comic, and he had a little bit where he talked about how this character, Apu, the head clerk at the Quickie Mart, was a constant source of irritation for him as a longtime fan of The Simpsons. And that, you know, other people would make fun of him when he was a child by calling him Apu. And there's even a moment in the documentary where he asks a group of South Asian performers from The Daily Show and other TV shows. There's about 4 or 5 of them. And he asks, you know, how many of you have been called Apu? And almost everyone raised their hand. Hmm. And the humor of the character is almost entirely wrapped up in this really exaggerated and not very authentic stereotypical accent that is voiced by a white man. And I think that is the main problem that Hari has with Apu and that a lot of people have with it. But it's his window into talking about a lot of the issues that South Asians face with their representation in media, how they're shown in TV and film, and how people who are professional actors and comics sort of have to deal with that when they go to get work, when they try to get roles in TV shows and things, and when they're asked to put on these exaggerated accents in order to get parts and things like that. In fact, there's a great montage in the documentary where we see how Apu is used and how much of the comedy sort of comes from what he says.
Apu, I see you're not in church.
Oh, but I am. I have a shrine to Ganesha, the god of worldly wisdom, located in the employee lounge.
Hey, Ganesha, want a peanut?
Please do not offer my god a peanut.
No offense, Apu, but when they were handing out religions, you must have been out taking a whiz.
Mr. Simpson, please pay for your purchases and get out and come again.
You know, if you just look at the text of that scene, it's not necessarily that funny. But, you know, there's something about the sing-songiness of the voice that adds a layer of humor to it, and that I think Simpsons fans in particular have responded to. But the problem is that feels really stereotypical and racist to actual Indian people.
Nobody in this documentary, by the way, says much good about this character Apu.
Exactly, and Hari has talks to a lot of different people. Talks to Aziz Ansari. He talks to Cal Penn. To Sakura Jaffrey, who people would remember. She played the first chief of staff on House of Cards. He talks to Asif Manvi. He talks to a lot of different South Asian people who are working in film and television, and all of them talk about the problematic stuff. You know, Sakura Jaffrey has this term, she brings up this term, patanking, as a way to refer to the sort of exaggerated speech that Indian actors are often asked to put on. And so what's interesting is the film is exploring that, but then we also get him sort of exploring how the character was created. And it seems, according to a producer who talked on a podcast that is featured in the film, they just wrote a line where a clerk said, 35 cents, please. And Hank Azaria, the voice actor, said it in an Indian accent, and they all laughed, and so this character was kind of born. And according to the producer, he had specifically noted on the script that it shouldn't be an Indian voice because he thought it would be a cliche. And so what's interesting to me is this film is sort of Hari's attempt to go to these guys and say, yes, this character is successful and a lot of people love him, but on the other hand was very stereotypical and problematic and should be changed.
But is this taking this too far? Can you have a comedy show without being allowed to exaggerate a character, whether it be somebody who's South Asian or somebody who's French or somebody who is any ethnicity from anywhere?
I think the lesson that I've learned from years of looking at this stuff is that if most of the character is wrapped up in something that's stereotypical, then that is a stereotypical character, and it encourages the audience to see that type of person through the stereotype. So if you have a character, say, like Cookie Lyons on Empire, she can be aggressive and violent. You know, she's a black woman. And these are things that we kind of associate with stereotypes about black women. But they also show her being very maternal and nurturing and smart and good at business. And so you get a well-rounded character that sometimes fits a stereotype, which you could say about people, right? So, you know, in places where there aren't any Indian people, Apu may be the only Indian person that enters into those viewers' lives, and he's very stereotypical.
Do you think, though, that part of the issue with Apu is this is a character that's been around for decades and times have changed?
I think that's definitely it. And in fact, there's a moment in the film where Dana Gould, the producer who once worked on The Simpsons, admits that if they were doing The Simpsons now, they probably wouldn't have Apu be voiced by a white man at the very least. I'm betting they wouldn't be able to present that character without having more shades to it. But that said, you can look around television and you can still find shows where there are terribly stereotypical characters because it is easy to sort of fall into that, you know, oh, well, this seems funny, and not think about the consequences of the humor that you're doing. And I think it particularly happens to ethnicities that are not black. Latino characters or Asian characters will be created in a stereotypical way that they would never do to a black character because it's been acknowledged that that's harmful and wrong.
Yeah, I think of Seinfeld has had many Asian characters, maybe the maitre d' at a Chinese restaurant, very exaggerated.
Well, and I think it's tough, too, when it's a supporting character. You know, Seinfeld has had several Asian characters, but they haven't been central characters. I mean, if an Asian character is a maitre d', they're going to have like three lines. You know, if the character's, delivering takeout food, which is another Asian character I remember from Seinfeld, I mean, they're only going to have a line or two. You know, you don't really have a lot of opportunities to make a character like that dimensional. But the thing about The Simpsons is it's been on so long that they have centered stories on Apu. We've seen his family. I think he had a cousin who was raised in America who didn't have an accent. You know, we've seen storylines that featured Apu. So, you know, they had the ability to make that character more dimensional, mm-hmm. but I don't think they did it often enough for it to affect how people see him.
Okay, one more thing, Eric, while we have you. I was watching Stranger Things, the new season of Stranger Things on Netflix the other day, and I noticed Paul Reiser is in it. He's having a moment, isn't he?
He really is. And it was great to see him cast on Stranger Things, too, because it really is a callback to a character that he played in the second Alien movie, in Aliens. So they cast Paul Reiser on Stranger Things, and it felt like a callback. Like, you see this character who's nice on the surface, but you're supposed to be suspicious of him, in part because you remember that he played another character like that, you know, in an 80s movie.
Right.
And there's a lot of 80s references in Stranger Things. And he's also got this really – he's executive producing this really interesting project called There's Johnny. And it's about this kid from the Midwest who mistakes a form letter – in response to a letter that he sent to Johnny Carson for a job offer. So he gets this form letter from Johnny Carson that he thinks is an offer to come work for Johnny Carson right after the Johnny Carson moved The Tonight Show from New York to L.A. in the early 70s. And so he goes on a pilgrimage out to L.A. and shows up on their doorstep and says, hey, I'm here for the job. And they're sort of like, what are you talking about? And the comedy is all about sort of the backstage shenanigans of putting on The Tonight Show in that moment when it had moved from New York to L.A., and they use actual footage from the actual Tonight Shows of the era to represent Johnny Carson and his guests and what the show was like. And then they have updated scenes with the actors depicting all the stuff that went on behind the scenes to make that show happen. So it's an interesting attempt to do something new. Tony Danza plays the executive producer of The Tonight Show. And Paul Reiser, who'd been on The Tonight Show, the Johnny Carson Tonight Show, I think something like 25 or 30 times, yeah, he's having a bit of a moment.
So if you've got a favorite character from an 80s TV show, now is the time to call the studios and tell them about it, because they will put them on a show right now. I guess 80s or 90s. Eric Deggans, NPR TV critic, thank you so much.
Nostalgia's always in. Thanks a lot, man.
The best-selling novel A Thousand Splendid Sons by Khaled Hosseini follows the lives of women in Afghanistan through many generations, and it's now in development as an opera in two acts. Hosseini had two requirements when he gave the composer permission: that when the female characters wear burqas in the book, they should wear them on stage, and that the Quran be handled with respect. Act two of this new, still unnamed work will have its premiere as a workshop performance in upstate New York this weekend. Act one had its premiere in Key West, Florida. Alicia Zuckerman from member station WLRN in Miami has our story.
Today I am 15, and I have never crossed the street.
I was driving down the highway at 70 miles an hour with the tears streaming down my face, and I thought, my God, this is so operatic.
The composer, Sheila Silver, had already read The Kite Runner by Khaled Hosseini. Then she picked up the author's second novel, A Thousand Splendid Sons, on tape from the library for the long drives back and forth from her job teaching music at SUNY Stony Brook on Long Island.
I fell in love with the two women characters. I just fell in love with them. They were so inspiring, and they were so courageous, and they were so human. And I thought that I want to tell their story.
The story of Mariam and Laila living in Afghanistan as the country changes, first because of the Soviet invasion, later the Taliban.
They're both women who are married generation apart to the same brutal man.
Silver imagined the story as an opera, but worried because it was long and complicated. On stage, she would only have about 2 or 3 hours. But for 3 years, she couldn't get it out of her head. Silver had worked on other projects with the librettist Stephen Kitsakos, and finally she called him.
Probably in the middle of the night, knowing me, and said, Steve, we can do this. We can do this. I know it. You got to read the book.
I think I read the novel in 2 sittings.
And he said, yes, we can do this. And then I went off to India to study Hindustani music to bring this color into my language.
The music of India has historical connections to the music of Afghanistan. To help develop the opera, Silver got a grant to support female opera composers. As confident as Kitsakos was that they could adapt the story.
It takes place over 40 years. There are many, many characters.
He had to let go of many of the book's details.
Because all of the description and all of the narrative is beautiful when you're reading a novel, but when you are putting these characters on stage, The music has to tell the story.
In this scene, after Mariam has been married off to Rashid, a much older man, she's at the market in Kabul for the first time. She's a teenager still and overwhelmed. Katsakas wanted to write this scene because it illustrates some of the burdens on women. And at the same time, there's some lightness in it, with women in bright headscarves asking about each other's lives and having fun together.
This is Hosseini's words. Mariam could hear their high-pitched chatter, their spiraling laughs. As she walked with her head down, she caught bits of their banter, which seemingly always had to do with sick children or lazy, ungrateful husbands. And then the line in italics, as if the meals cook themselves.
As if the meals cook themselves.
And he took some license in imagining more of what the women might be talking about in the market.
One of the women says, but your husband is so handsome. And she's like, yeah, but not so much in bed. And one of the other women responds, she says, oh, but mine is quite spectacular in that department. And I wasn't even sure that the words in that department were singable. But Sheila said, absolutely.
There is a moment when you think Rashid might be good to Mariam. But then it takes a bitter turn. She cooks food he doesn't like, and he forces her to take a mouthful of rocks and chew. In the second act of the opera, Rashid takes a second wife, that's Lila, a woman who was supposed to become educated, a woman who was supposed to have a career. Tragedies and injustice derail that for her, and Mariam becomes an even more tragic figure, but also a savior. The composer, Sheila Silver, says their stories deserve to be told.
And if we can feel love for them and respect for them and appreciate their courage, we're opening doors.
The second act of A Thousand Splendid Sons premieres in Hudson, New York this weekend. The workshop performance is happening under the specter of daily revelations about sexual harassment and assault of women here in this country. For Here and Now, I'm Alicia Zuckerman in Miami.
This is my reward, ungrateful daughter, listening to his lies.
Beautiful. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now.